The 29th of July, 1958 was a warm, sunny day in Dublin. He went to 7 o'clock Mass as usual in Church Street, or could it have been John's Lane? We don't know, but we do know that he helped Mrs. Mulhall remove the heavy wooden shutters from her shop front window at number, well, we're not quite sure, North King Street. He would have been travelling by bike, a bike he had christened Trigger. He was our father, and we would never see him again. Back home in Manor Street in Stony Batter, we had risen to a beautiful summer's morning. By the time I was up, my brother Matt, who was 6 years older than me, had already mixed a bucket of whitewash using water and Reckitt's Blue, all done under the watchful eye of our mother. The reason for the whitewash was that our house had a backyard and the wall that faced onto the kitchen was used as a trap to reflect sunlight into a very dark room. It was the sound of the new doorbell that stopped the work. My father had just installed it a few days previous. It had a luminous red light at its centre. Bzzz. I stood in the back hall and watched as my father's bike Trigger and my brother Shay's bike Topper were led in, but both of them were being led by strangers. I can still feel that midsummer heat and smell the floor polish on the lino floor. I can still see the blanched face of my mother. Which of them is it? She knew right away that either her husband or her son had been killed. She just didn't know which one. Soon the house was crammed with people, family, neighbours, priests, nuns, while aunts in flowery aprons made sandwiches and pots of tea. Hushed groups whispered in corners. I could hear them. 10 children, Lord save us. They say the good die young. Oh, you're right there, Jack. An uncle put his hand on my head. God help you, you poor gossin. A neighbour gave me a shilling. My grandmother in the black shawl mouthed silent prayers with rosary beads clasped in her fingers. My mother sat surrounded in the parlour, streamed in sunlight, shaken and distraught, like a little bird with a broken wing. The two bicycles leaned against the wall in the hall, and two unpacked lunches rested on the hall table. Later in the afternoon, my brothers and I were sent to our Aunt Peggy, who lived on Carnew Street. Our cousins invited us to play football with the other lads in the back lane. The game was very competitive, and suddenly the day became normal again. A couple of hours later, we were called in for tea. At the back gate of the house, a group of kids stood around a dead cat. One of them poked it with a stick. Another rolled its bicycle wheel over its stomach. My brother Matt looked at me and said, "Daddy's dead." "I know," I said, pretending I hadn't forgotten. After tea, we all went for a walk in the Phoenix Park. Although it was evening time, the heat was becoming even more intense and dark clouds filled the skies over Dublin. We decided to head home and were passing Ockram Street Chapel when a sheet of lightning followed by the roar of thunder stopped us in our tracks. The heavens opened. We ran into the church porch for refuge. From there we could see the life-size crucifixion scene with hail and rain lashing against the face of the dead Christ. I asked my brothers, "Is this the end of the world?" But they just laughed. Later, lying in bed, I looked out the window at the now calm, silvery sky. I tossed and turned. At the back of my mind was the nagging thought that maybe I was in some way the cause of what had happened. Dawn was breaking and the Angelus bell was ringing in Stanhope Street Convent when I finally fell asleep. I dreamt I saw him walking along the bull wall. He was playing his harmonica. He was far in the distance and I called to him, "Daddy, Daddy, you're alive, you're alive." But he couldn't hear me and didn't look back. He just kept playing his harmonica, walking slowly towards the sea until I couldn't see him anymore. The earliest memory I have of my father is being brought down to the back room when I was sick and being given an Aspro. I'd had a nightmare. My father was lighting his pipe. The name of the tobacco was Friendly, and it came in a bar wrapped in cellophane. He struck a match and it seemed like silver stars glowed on the ceiling as he inhaled. My mother held me in her arms and I fell asleep as my father smoked his pipe, and that safe, beautiful feeling will live with me forever. My father was a carpenter, and on the day he died, he was installing sash windows on the fourth floor of a block of flats that was being constructed in Summerhill. My eldest brother, Shay, who was only 18 at the time, was working with him. Years later, Shay told me what had happened. My father was on the scaffolding, which was made of timber, and Shay was inside the building. He was having a problem holding a very heavy lintel, and my father told him to pass it through the window to him. That's when the scaffold plank broke in two. He fell 40 feet and was killed instantly. I learned from my mother that a few weeks before he was killed, he told her that some of the scaffolding planks were rotten. This still haunts me. The fact that he knew of the danger but was willing to take the risk so he could provide for his family. It was only when I was grown up that she started talking to me about him again. She told me he was afraid of the dark ever since he was a child, when during the War of Independence, the British Army raided the house in the middle of the night and put a gun to his father's head. And she spoke of their last night together in 81 Manor Street. She said they heard a dog barking all night, and ever since then she hated that sound. I can see them in my mind's eye, holding each other close in the bed in the small room, not knowing that this would be their last night together, listening to a dog barking in the darkness.
There's a lot of guff talked about travel writing. It's something, after all, that's done best by people who simply love travelling and discovering new places, and who happen to have a gift for communicating that passion to those sitting at home in Ballyhaunus or Birmingham or Biarritz or wherever. But every once in a while, a genius emerges, a true guru. And when it comes to the best and the brightest of them all, Patrick Lee Fermor remains unrivalled, right out there in a class of his own. For here was a man who travelled for the sheer joy of it. How else do you explain how, back in 1933, on a wet December day, he made his way from his English home to the Hook of Holland and set off from there on his odyssey to walk all the way to Constantinople at just 18 years of age? That epic journey, which he completed in 13 months, eventually translated into what was to be a book trilogy. The first one, A Time of Gifts, was published in 1977 and recounts his exploits and encounters as far as Hungary. The second, Between the Woods and the Water, which, like the first, was written entirely from memory, took another decade to appear in print and takes the reader as far as Romania. And then, sadly posthumously, for he left this life 8 years ago this summer at the great age of 96, the final part of that trilogy, The Broken Road, eventually made it into print 2 years after he had passed away. Paddy works very slowly, his publishers once told me when I rang up to inquire years and years ago if that final book was imminent. I have been enthralled to Patrick Lee Fermor since I first discovered two things in the mid-80s. First, there was his beautifully written Time of Gifts book. And second was the fact that he had been a dashing war hero, involved with the British forces in German-occupied Crete, living and fighting alongside the islanders, and playing a central role in the boys' own style kidnapping of the German commander on the island, General Kreipu. I had begun to visit Crete regularly in the early 80s and had become fascinated with its World War II history and with all the stories of the resistance. And now, here I discovered, on coming upon a copy of A Time of Gifts, was a man who had lived and fought with the Cretan resistance for months on end in the perilous White Mountains. A man who fought alongside George Sakoundakis, author of The Cretan Runner, one of the most engaging books ever written about those war years on the Mediterranean island. Lee Fermor, a gifted classical scholar and linguist, had translated his friend George's manuscript and written the introduction to the book. My fascination spurred me into action. I simply couldn't let it go. I would find out where he was, ask him if I could come and interview him for the newspaper I then worked for, and so, finally, lay my curiosity to rest. So in the late summer of 1993, I rang his publishers in London, inquiring about the third part of the book trilogy. That's when I was told that the great man worked very, very slowly. I wouldn't want to be holding my breath, in other words, in anticipation of the third part of his odyssey. Okay then, so no book in the offing, but still, how could I get in touch with him? I secured a postal address and discovered that he lived with his wife Joan in a remote house in mainland Greece, in a home in the Peloponnese that he had built himself in a setting that directly overlooked the sea. He had fallen in love in a time of war, and it was a love affair that was to consume him all his life, a passion for a country and its people that he never shook off. Yes, Greece had claimed Paddy Lee Fermor, body and soul. And so I wrote him a letter, inquiring about the elusive third book and asking him if I could come to Greece to interview him. Some weeks later, he wrote back. I have the letter still, folded away inside my paperback copy of A Time of Gifts. Cardamyle, Messenia, Greece is pre-printed at the top of the now discoloured white paper. In English on the right-hand corner, in Greek on the left. The rest of the page is covered with his spindly, spider crawling across the page handwriting. Dated 8/10/1993, he thanks me for my kind and encouraging words, rejoices in my love of Crete, and suggests, in relation to the interview request, that something might be done when my final walk volume is finished. It never happened. And now, of course, he's gone. But his spirit still looms large, for there has been something of a Patrick Lee Fermor literary explosion in recent years. First, in tearing haste, the letters written between Paddy and his old friend, the aristocratic and debullient Deborah Devonshire, made a reappearance, followed, shortly after, by Artemus Cooper's sparkling biography of the man himself. And then, finally, Paddy's third walk volume, as he called it himself, hit the bookshops. With a little help from his friends, of course. And so, if you do nothing else this summer, treat yourself to Paddy's Walk trilogy and read the story of the young man with the indomitable spirit and the thirst for discovery who set off in 1933 to walk all by himself across the continent of Europe until he reached journey's end at the gates of Constantinople. Just as Paddy Lee Fermor, restless romantic and surely one of the greatest travel writers of all time, has finally reached his own journey's end. His eyes closed forever on a world that captivated him all his life. Those cloud-capped towers, the gorgeous palaces, the solemn temples, the great globe itself.
Often the loneliness in others prompts us to acknowledge the loneliness in ourselves. We knew what it was to be hidden, to be silent, to feel forgotten. I have a friendship that spans over 30 years. We found each other in college. You might say she sought me out. She was organised and determined. I remember her telling me once how circumstances in life sometimes call upon us to organise our second families. We already had a connection. Our grandmothers would have camped together during the 60s and 70s. But from an early age, Mary Elizabeth was adopted into a settled family. In college, my disabled and traveller identity encircled me. The invitation to be part of Mary Elizabeth's gay family enriched me. She said we were sisters, and that for most of her life, I was the only traveller she knew. On becoming friends with her, my world became less lonely. We moved through our 20s and 30s, building our careers and nourishing our friendship. Every broken romance that bruised my heart, she would reassure me that love would come my way. Mary Elizabeth spent 2 summers at Boston University. During that time, she had her first romance. We spoke and Skyped for 2 hours each week. Watching my best friend surrendering to love was captivating. After some time, Mary Elizabeth's American love issued an ultimatum. Boston or nothing. A decision had to be made. The idea of Mary Elizabeth moving to another country was too painful. As she was weighing up the pros and cons of moving, my heart was filled with familiar pain. Then she phoned one evening. My prayers were answered. Boston was not happening. 2015, Friday evening. Mary Elizabeth and her girlfriend Helen had been out canvassing. My job was to have the dinner in. Helen was her real love. Mary Elizabeth had whispered, one way or the other, we're going to get married. There was a mixture of giddiness and nervousness in her, in all of us. The intensity seemed to spread right across the city, through the whole country. The arrangement for Saturday was to meet on Dame Street, then head towards Dublin Castle, where the count was to be announced. It was probably the first time in my life that when I voted, I felt what was being asked of me was generosity. Digging deep, the wounds of several generations were being healed, each cohort remembering what they had lived through, the pain, the isolation, the belief that they would never be fully part of their own family, never be an equal citizen. That day would change all that. On Dame Street that Saturday afternoon, my phone was buzzing. The rainbow flag was displayed on every shop front. People were carrying it, wearing it. The crowds were big but magnanimous. Music was playing. Mary Elizabeth was giving me instructions as to where to find her and Helen. The crowd parted. My eyes darted everywhere on the street. Then I saw Mary Elizabeth come running towards me. There we were, traveller and settled, touching love. She grabbed and hugged me like we were teenagers all over again. Embracing Helen, wiping her tears, I felt like private and public history were colliding. All that darkness and shame now passed into the embers. We partied all that Saturday night, dancing barefoot to music from the 60s, 70s and 80s. On the Sunday morning, we met for breakfast. Mary Elizabeth looked coy, showing me the diamond on her finger. Helen said, we're ringing the registry tomorrow, a June wedding next year. Will you be our best woman? Best woman. It's a role given to travel matriarchs at wedding ceremonies. They can be cousins, widows, friends, a woman who's considered vital to the union and celebration of a couple's marriage. The day finally arrived. Mary Elizabeth had insisted we book into a hotel room and that Helen wouldn't see her until the ceremony. The night before her wedding celebration, Helen warned us to go easy on the Prosecco. We had our hair done, as brides and their bridesmaids, or their best women, always do. As time drew near for Mary Elizabeth to make her way down to the garden, we embraced. Her dress, chiffon midnight blue, tight-fitting, with a fur shrug over her shoulders, was stunning. There was a white canopy in the garden, chairs covered in white satin with blue ribbons to match Mary Elizabeth's wedding dress. And we silently saluted the glorious mix of chance, courage and conviction that is our friendship.
There were too many people living in my flat, and Nikki was still at home with her mum. So usually when we went out, we did just that. We walked around the streets of Clerkenwell talking and window shopping, or sat at bus stops eating chips and sheltering from the rain. Towards the end of the week, we'd sometimes dig through our pockets and treat ourselves to a drink or a trip to the pictures. That evening, we'd been to one of the Odeon cinemas that were dotted across London's West End, and after the film, I'd walk Nikki to the station. She waved as the escalator carried her away, and I quickly climbed back up to street level to catch a bus home. On the way to Trafalgar Square, I stopped, and sitting on the steps of a large office building, smoked a cigarette. When it was finished, I stubbed it out against the heel of my shoe and got back to my feet. But I was no sooner upright when two men crossed the road and hurried toward me. One of the men was wearing the uniform of the Metropolitan Police. "Excuse me, sir," his casually dressed colleague called out. "Could we have a word?" I stopped and looked at them. "Of course. What have you been up to tonight?" the man went on. "I've been smoking a cigarette," I said, and I pointed back towards the steps. "Over there." "Been trying car door handles, have we?" the uniformed policeman asked. "No," I said, and thinking to establish a lack of motive, added, "I can't drive." "Don't need to drive to steal things from the glove compartment, do you?" the plainclothes policeman interrupted me. I had to admit that he was right. "If you've not been trying car door handles," his colleague continued, "what have you been up to?" "I've been to the pictures," I replied. "Whereabouts?" "The Odeon Haymarket." "And what's showing there at the moment?" "The Tin Drum." There was a brief pause. "They've painted themselves into a corner," I said to myself. "They don't know anything about German art house cinema, and they will now make their excuses and leave." I could not have been more wrong. "Any good?" "Yes," I said, it's very good. "And have you read the book?" "I'm sorry?" "The film is based on a book by Günter Grass. Have you read it?" I shook my head. "For several reasons." "No?" "Oh, you should," the uniformed policeman told me. "It's brilliant." "What's your name?" they asked, and I gave it to them along with my address, glad that the conversation was now taking a more traditional path. "You working at the moment?" "I work at the Tate Gallery," I told them truthfully. "Got the David Hockney retrospective on at the moment, haven't you?" "Oh, for God's sake," I said to myself. "This is like being interrogated by Melvin Bragg." "Yes," I said. "My wife and I went over to Paris to see the exhibition when it was there," the plainclothes policeman told me. "But I understand," he went on, "that some new material's been added now that it's in London." "Yes," I said, I heard that too. "Have to stop by sometime and check it out," he said with a smile. "If you're there, maybe we'll come and say hello." A few minutes later, the conversation having wound down, they hurried away to fight crime in some other part of the city, and I jumped on a bus and went home. A couple of weeks later, Nicky dumped me, and I went to the seaside to cheer myself up. When I got to work the following morning, the head of security called me to his office. I didn't have any idea why he would want to see me, and things got no clearer when he said, "We had a policeman in here yesterday asking for you." Not knowing why such a thing would happen, I said only, "Oh?" For the first time since I'd been working with him, the head of security gave me what might pass for a smile. "He asked me to give you this." He pushed a paper bag across his desk. "Go on, then." I opened the bag and took out a small leather-bound book. On the cover I read, "Die Blecktrommel." It was a copy of Günter Grass's novel, The Tin Drum, in German.
The Last Peacock. George, the last peacock, nibbles and picks at the grubs on tree bark, fallen leaves, shrubs the name of which I've forgotten. And in his own fashion of walking, heads our way, the little crests sparkling in the sun like jade, indigo, this zestfulness, unattached and alone. So it came as no surprise that night, as we held on in the gathering storm, to barely spot him tucked up in a tangle of branches, blue eyes in the darkness, blink, blink.
Too exhausted to drive any further into Cornwall, we eventually found a sprawling campsite on an exposed hill above the sea. It was packed with tents, campervans and surfers, some of them already carrying six packs for the Saturday night party. "We're not going to get much sleep here." "No." John dragged the tent out of the boot as it started to rain, and suppressing the urge to snap at each other, we managed to get the thing up, then drive to the nearest seaside village for fish and chips, which we ate in the car, washed down with a small bottle of wine that stained our teeth. Through the rain-washed windscreen, hundreds of surfers in the sea. Some fell, others stayed upright all the way into shore, and yet others were lying on surfboards paddling back out. Mesmerised by their comings and goings and the steep grey waves, we fell into a reverie. We were waiting for the baby to be born in Mumbles in Wales, where Shane and Louise were living in a house overlooking the sea, a birth pool erected in the sitting room. Knowing that our very presence was asking that tactless question, anything stirring, we took ourselves off to explore Cornwall, a landscape made beloved through our reading of authors like Daphne du Maurier, Rosamund Pilcher, Winston Graham and Patrick Gale. But the initial enthusiasm that had brought us on this mythical journey was waning as we weaved our way back through wind and rain to the campsite. "Oh, look," I said, pointing to a tent that was being shredded by the wind, the tent pole sticking up through the roof. "Those poor, unfortunate people." "For Christ's sake, that's our bloody tent." "What?" as I began to recognise the familiar green and blue skin of it. Without consultation, we decided not to embarrass ourselves by taking it down in front of the cool surfers, and executing a nifty three-point turn, John drove towards the exit, abandoning what had been our only shelter. "It's a sign," he said. "We're too old for tents." But it was high season, and as we travelled from one bed and breakfast to another, the no vacancy signs blowing in the rising wind, the place started to feel like the bleak moors and Wrecker's Coves and Du Maurier's novels. Finally, a woman with a lilting Cornish accent took pity on us and showed us out to a mobile home parked behind her house. With relief, we lit the stove, made mugs of tea and searched for a good film on the tiny television. For the next 3 days, we rested and slept as storm winds shook the mobile. "Thanks be to God we're not camping out in this. I told you, it's a sign." When the rain eased, we went looking for the towns and fishing villages we'd read about, like Truro, St. Ives and Porthcurris. Some of the names didn't exist, except in the writer's mind, though I searched every signpost for those places. And in Penzance, we followed in Patrick Gale's footsteps to the Methodist chapel and the birthplace of the Brontë's mother. But our hearts weren't in it, because we were all the time waiting for news of the baby. Eventually, we decided to make our way back to Swansea and found ourselves in Mothercare first, then near the house where Dylan Thomas was reared, and finally in Tesco's looking for another tent. This time we stayed closer, camping on the Gower Peninsula, safely sheltered by a fuchsia hedge. On the 18th of July, after a breakfast of fresh croissants and strawberries in the campsite cafe, I took a stroll through a wood that opened out onto dunes and a wide beach with pale white sand. Sun scorched the back of my neck as I made my way across the beach and into the sea, cringing when the cold waves splashed up over my tummy, remembering my daughter asking if I wanted to feel the baby kicking, and the way my hand went out so naturally, and there she was, whisper soft, then stronger, drum, drum, thrumming from the other side. Like the surfers waiting for the crest, the curve, the break, I surrendered to the sea's rhythm that hot day on the Gower as Sarah made her way, wave by wave, into our lives.
On this morning's programme, we heard A Dog Barking in the Darkness by J.M. Dolan. Patrick Lee Fermor, Restless Romantic by Rosalind D. Friendship and Family by Rosaline McDonough, read by Kathleen Lawrence. The Art Police by Chris McCallum. The Last Peacock, a poem by Gerald Daw. And A Hot Day on the Gower by Lanny O'Hanlon.